No, I want to ask a question. I want to start with a poll. I want to see what kind of people we are. I'm very curious. I've got a few questions for you about looking into the future. And so I'm curious, if you could look into some portal that would show you the future, if you could look into that and know all the hardships that life would throw at you, would you take a look through that portal? How many of you? Oh my, wow. No? Okay. What about this? If you could look into the future and you would know the day you were going to die, would you do it? Really? Wow, I would look for all of them. Okay, what about this? If you could hear what people would say about you at your funeral. Oh, now we're curious. Okay. The parents, if you could look into the future and see where your kids would be at, say, age 30. Oh, that's interesting. I'm like, it surprises me how many people are like, I don't want to know. I would take the bait on all of those. Fortune telling, looking into the future. I want to introduce you to a painting that's a curiosity to me. This is called The Fortune Teller, an oil painting by the French artist Georges de Latour. And its story and meaning are certainly curious. You see, it's assumed this work was created in the early 1600s, but the painting was only discovered just after World War II, which means this piece somehow disappeared for over 300 years. Now, as the story goes, the discovery of the painting is sort of traced back to this French prisoner of war who, after World War II, he's out of prison, and he's looking through a montage or a monograph of Georges de Latour's paintings, and he thinks to himself, wow, these paintings have a resemblance to a painting I know hanging in my relative's home. And so he asks a knowledgeable priest to come and take a look at it. And sure enough, they say, my goodness, this is a lost Georges de Latour painting. And once word gets out that a new painting of his has been discovered, everyone wants to see it and every museum wants to buy it and own it. Because they knew exhibiting this new work would pay great dividends for them in the future. But this art dealer named Georges Wildenstein, he sneaks into the mix and outbids everyone and buys the painting for 7.5 million francs in 1949. That's about 10 million Canadian. Today's worth about 100 million. And for a decade, it remains in his private collection. And again, all the while, these museums are trying to offer him something lucrative enough to sell it. And of course, museums, they keep looking and asking for it. Of course they want this. For a museum to have this piece in their collection would guarantee them many more millions of profits in future grants, sponsorships, tourism, visits. To have a Latour painting in your museum is a massive investment in your future. And so eventually, the Met in New York City convinces Georges Wildenstein to part with this painting for an undisclosed but very high sum of money. And the history of this painting being found and sought after and ending up in the Met is kind of funny to me given the message of the painting. You see, we know that Georges de Latour was highly influenced by Caravaggio, and Caravaggio's works were often cautionary tales. Like Caravaggio, de Latour seems to be telling a moral story here, offering a caution to his viewers. And so the work captures this moment. You can see when this young man, he's distracted by having his fortune told to him by an old woman, he's robbed by her companions. And the caution of the scene seems to be this. The young man is so preoccupied with looking into the future that he doesn't realize he's being robbed of the present. Distracted by what he hopes to find in the future, he's losing what he already has in the moment. And it's kind of comical. You can see the woman on the far left picking his pocket. The woman behind her has her hand outstretched to receive the loot. And then, of course, the woman there with the shifty eyes is cutting off his gold medallion as he listens to what the future might be telling him. Worrying about the future robs you of the present. And what makes this artistic message even more poignant to me is how the rest of the story with the painting itself unfolds. You see, the Met acquired this as an investment in their future, but perhaps the museum directors of the Met should have paid more attention to the moral of the painting than the worth of the painting itself, because in 1984, the piece's authenticity as a Georges Latour was called into question by world-renowned art critic Christopher Wright. He has a lot of technical suspicions about this work, a lot of minute details that I won't go into, but he was suspicious, really. A painting not seen for 300 years shows up claiming it's worth millions. In his mind, this is not a Georges Latour, but a forgery used to scam art dealers and museums out of millions. And the Met still insists, no, this is an authentic piece, but there's something funny about Rosemarie and Rainer Hagen, their art critics. They smirk when they say this. There's a certain piquancy in the proximity of Wright's hypothesis of the painting as a forgery to the shady double-dealing shown in the fortune teller itself. We evidently live in a world of lies and deceptions in which not only immature youths, but also museum directors can be fleeced by cunning rascals and hopes for the future. Huh. Distracted by the future, we are often robbed of the present, robbed of what we already have and what's right in front of us. I need to tell you about having my appendix out this summer, and I've struggled with how to communicate this. There's so many things I could tell you about what happened. What I'm not going to do is I'm not going to tell you about the conversation I had with a woman after my surgery who had also had her appendix out and claimed it was worse than childbirth. But I'm not going to go there. I don't want to bring that up. I don't want that to be a part of how I tell the story. But there I was down at my parents' trailer, which is close to Stratford, and the pain that had been developing in my stomach that day was reaching a fever pitch to the point where I said, something's got to give. I think I got to go to the hospital. And so I called Kristen, who was at home, and she picked up the phone while on a bike ride. And so she's panting while she's talking to me. I said, listen, I need to go to the hospital. To which she said, I'm on a bike ride. What do you want me to do about that? And I said, care. How about starting with caring? She's like, well, I'll get done my bike ride. I'll try to get down there. Thanks, honey. So my dear mother drives me to the airport and get in. X-ray, CT scan, all the bit. They're like, we think this thing's going to blow. We got to get it out. And so there we were. Kristen finally arrives. It's getting close to midnight. They're like, we're going to take it out. And it's a pretty routine surgery, so we'll have you out sometime 3 a.m. So Kristen now has to stay till 3 a.m. And their willingness, they come to my room or whatever, and they say, okay, it's time to go. And so they're wheeling me down the cart, in the cart down the hall to the surgery room when they say to Kristen, okay, you stay here. And then they just kept going with me. And there was, I was really high at the time on morphine, which was great. But I had this thing like, wait, I didn't even get to say goodbye. I didn't get to give Kristen a kiss. Goodbye. And they kept wheeling me. And then they put me in this hall and they said, okay, we need to just prep the surgery room, so we'll come back and get you 10:15. And so I'm left there on my own. I hadn't been able to say goodbye to Kristen, and suddenly there was like this anxiety attack that I had laying there, because my mind suddenly was flooded with these future imagination scenarios. I was thinking, I know this is routine, but there's always a chance something could go wrong. And so I'm sitting there, and I'm trying to figure out what's going on, and then I'm thinking, oh my goodness, well, what if I'm in chronic pain for the rest of my life after this? I know they're going to shove a tube down my throat. What if they ruin my vocal box? I could never speak again. And I start thinking about these situations, and then I think about my kids. Oh my goodness, what if I can't wrestle with them anymore? What if I die? And I'm picturing them 40 years in the future, and people going, well, tell us about your dad. They're like, we don't remember. And I'm like, oh no. I'm like, oh, that would be so awful. And then I started thinking about Kristen and be like, oh my goodness, will she remarry? And I was like, oh, what if in her grief she makes a mistake and marries some schluck? And she lives out the rest of her days miserable in marriage, and I'm picturing this, and then something even worse pops into my mind. I'm like, wait, what if she marries someone better than me? Oh my goodness. Oh, what if the kids love this person? He's never tired or cranky. He plays with them all the time. He's rich. He's so sexy. Kristen can't keep her hands off him. I'm like, all these, I'm picturing this scenario in the future. And then they come out and they get me and they bring me into the room and they're like, hop up on this bed. And I'm not kidding you. It was a cross-shaped bed. And I got on the cross and they tied down my arms and I said, Jesus, I love you, but this is going a little too far, it feels like. And they strapped down my legs. And the next thing, they put that mask on me and poof, out. And I'm here, so I survived. But when I woke up, the very first thing I heard and saw, I woke up groggy and I could see Kristen's face. I was like, oh, you didn't remarry. And she said, stay awake. I said, what? What? I love you. She said, I don't care about that. Stay awake. If you can't stay awake, they're going to have to put you in for the night, which means I'm going to have to drive home, get an hour of sleep, come and pick you up, so stay awake. And I kept passing out, and I don't know why the hospital sees fit to have a buzzer. They had this alarm thing. Every time I fell asleep, there'd be just bam, and I'd be like, oh, it's, and Christy just, stay awake. I'm trying to, oh. It was horrible. Well, the whole thing was a rather curious experience for me, and it's all good, but besides my wife not having a lot of sympathy for me, what stuck out most to me was that moment in the hall waiting for surgery, and I'm thinking about the future, and I'm afraid, and I'm conjuring up these storylines of what might happen without me, and I'm playing through these scenarios, living into them, getting anxious. And this is what someone named Paul Young calls future tripping. It's something I'm sure we can all relate to a little bit. Future tripping is simply this, creating imaginations of what might happen in the future and then actually taking a mental and emotional trip to live there for a bit. And in those mental trips, we explore questions like, oh my goodness, what am I going to do if this terrible thing happens? And then we live out, we imagine, okay, I'll do this and this. What am I going to do if I make a terrible mistake in life and it sort of ruins all of my life? Maybe, oh my goodness, I think my friends are mad at me. How's this next conversation going to play out? What if my partner's cheating on me? What am I going to do? Oh my goodness, what if my kids get abused or hurt? And we start living into these future imagined scenarios. What if I get this disease? What if that happens? What if I lose my job? There's scores of these questions that we ask ourselves. Future tripping is the act of playing out these future scenarios in our mind, living there for a bit. I think you get the idea. And here is sort of where the painting comes back to me. It reminds us, future trip often enough, and you'll end up getting fleeced of the present, like the man in the painting. And why? These imaginary trips, they have no substance. They're not real. They're simply anxiety-invoking fantasies. And they're imaginations in our head, but we start treating them like they're real, but they're not. And like the wealthy young man trying to learn his future while being scammed of what he has, like the museum trying to ensure future profits, ending up with a forgery, flirt too much with the future, spend too much time there mentally, and what can happen is you get fleeced out of the present, robbed of what you already have. And Paul Young also reminds us of this important thing. God does not dwell in anything that is not real. And so when we live in a posture of worry and anxiety about the future, continually speculate in our minds about future scenarios, God is often in those imaginations absent. And in that space, we end up missing what we do have, what is right in front of us. And I think this is a bit about what Jesus is getting at with his words on the Sermon on the Mount. Therefore, I tell you, do not worry about your life, what you will eat or drink, or about your body, what you will wear. Can any one of you, by worrying, add a single hour to your life? Seek first his kingdom and his righteousness, and all these things will be given to you as well. Therefore, do not worry about tomorrow, for tomorrow can worry about itself. Each day has enough trouble of its own. Now, I think there's two layers of wisdom here. The first is a rather obvious one. Don't worry or stress about the tomorrow and the future. Why? Because we have very little power over it. It's not like our imagination scenarios can actually change something that hasn't happened yet. There are very few benefits to worry. I mean, it's not like you sort of go, hey, honey, let's grab a bottle of wine, spend tonight worrying about things. It's not like any of us enjoy stressing, thinking about the future. And so the thing is, for most of us, though, it's like one of these things that's on autopilot. We just do. We know we shouldn't worry, perhaps, but our minds just go there. Don't allow your mind to worry about imagined futures, because God's doesn't dwell in anything that's not real. And so there's an obvious layer of wisdom here, which is simply this: to pursue the path of Jesus is to remain fully awake, aware, and present to today, this moment, this situation. But there's a less obvious wisdom here about this passage that I think is worth mentioning. And while this is good wisdom, this idea of not worrying, I'm inclined to think very few people stop worrying when you ask them to stop worrying. How many times have we been in conversation with a friend or partner who's worrying, and you're like, hey, you should stop worrying? Very rarely does that work, right? Oh, gee, okay, thanks, I'll stop worrying. And so there's this individual level. Being told on an individual level to stop worrying can actually, it can be a bit toxic or harmful. If we read these words of Jesus as directed to me, Brad, stop worrying, I think it becomes problematic. Because here's the thing, for instance, if you lose your job, it might make sense to worry about how you're going to pay for your mortgage. If you are suddenly unable to work, it might make sense actually to worry about how you're going to put food on the table. That not only seems reasonable, it might actually even be necessary. And so there's an obvious wisdom here. Okay. I think the reality, though, is that on an individual level, ridding ourselves of worry and anxiety is not only impossible, at times I think it would be unwise to even try, which is why there's more to this passage that we often miss. And I think it starts with this. When Jesus says, therefore I tell you, do not worry, he's not talking to you. He's speaking to us. The you is plural. And the thing is this, we Western Christians love to individualize every verse of the Bible, imagining these words are being spoken directly to us, but it's not. Matthew's writing to a community. In fact, every single book of the Bible is not written to an individual, but to a community. This is not individual advice. Sort of take home some individual wisdom here. This is communal advice. Jesus is speaking to we, not to me. And I think because we live in this radically individualistic culture, it's so scarred our imaginations, it never occurs to us, wait, maybe the Bible's talking towards a community, not to me. And the thing is this, when you read this as a communal advice, there's a whole other level of wisdom here, because when Jesus says or goes on to say, instead of worry, pursue his kingdom and path above all else, then all these things are going to be added to you. All the things that you worry or stress about will be taken care of. And so I think what Matthew is doing to his community is saying this, look, if as a community you collectively pursue Jesus' path, his kingdom of kindness, hospitality, generosity, love, forgiveness, being patient and gentle, bearing each other's burdens, if you collectively pursue that, what you're going to find is you have a whole lot less to worry about in life. And so I think what Jesus is getting at is this: if you walk in a community of people committed to Jesus' path, surrounded by people who are committed and prioritizing Jesus' path, you would know a life of less worry and anxiety. And why? Because you would know you'll be taken care of. If you're in a community that's committed to Jesus' path and hardship comes your way, you will know you'll be taken care of. You would know you're going to be offered grace, even in times of personal failure or shame. You would know you will find yourself cared for, even when we aren't able to carry ourselves. And I think that's what Jesus is getting at. Listen, if we're all pursuing this path, then what do any of us have to worry about? You will find worry visits you less often if you're in a community that's prioritizing Jesus' kingdom and path, which for any community, I would say this is a tall order. I mean, honestly, we live in a world that stresses us out. It makes us worry. It makes us anxious, and quite frankly, for good reason. There are good reasons to worry as individuals, but what would it be like to be able to claim that being part of this community tangibly and noticeably reduces worry, stress, and anxiety in life? How could we become a community that when people honestly get invested in it, they say, huh, you know what? Being part of this community has me worrying less about the future. I find myself not as anxious or stressed these days. That's a tall order for a community, a very tall order. And to be honest, this would probably be a really good time for me to lay out some vision about how to achieve that, which I don't have. All I have is this, Jesus' communal call to pursue his kingdom and righteousness and his path above all else. How do we do that? I want to revisit the little way we talked about and explored together last spring. And of course, the little way's crucial idea is this: stay inside the moment. Be present to now, to what is right in front of me, and then be loving and gracious to that thing. And my hope is that, you know, given the summer and whatnot, my hope is that by now, enough of us have been practicing the little way to realize just how tough it is, but also how beautiful it is. Was reminded that of this week. I was talking to Steve over here, who informed me that he's a coupon collector now. He's got a little app on his phone, little coupons, so that when he goes grocery shopping, as his stuff is being checked out, he can be like, excuse me, wait, I've got a coupon for that. And then the lady's going to have to spend 5 minutes marking in his discount of 30 cents on chicken. And he's telling me about this. And I said, I hate people like you in the checkout line. You're driving the rest of us crazy. Oh, I said, I would be sending you stink eyes so bad, like just daggers with my eyes. Like, I know, it's bad. But then, is Jen here? Or she's not, is she upstairs? Where Jen pipes in with what I would call a rather preachy voice, and says, Brad, preacher man, what? Didn't you just tell us about this little way where we're supposed to love people even in checkout lines? In fact, she said, didn't you literally show us a video, and the video was entirely about how we react in the checkout line? Yes, I did, Jen. Thank you for that reminder. But it's tough to live this way, to actually be mindful all the time. And so as we begin our season, I want to call us back there, back to staying inside today, the moment, being present to now, awake to what is right in front of us and working to bring love and grace and beauty to that, whatever it is. And to do that, I want to introduce you to the art of Andy Goldsworthy. His art, I just discovered him this summer. His art and the way he creates are such a lovely metaphor for the little way, how to travel, I think, the Christian path, how to seek God's kingdom first. And a large part of Goldsworthy's art is this. What he's most notable for is he simply wanders out into the natural world with nothing on him, and then he uses natural materials he finds about him to create these beautiful pieces. And so he'll use stones and thorns and leaves and flowers and branches and ice. And he does his work. And what he does is he simply imposes a bit of temporary order on the randomness of nature. And if you watch the video from the Nexus Weekly, how many of you watched the video I sent out in the Nexus Weekly? There's just a pitch to sign up for the Nexus Weekly so you can see videos like that. But if you watch the video, his technique is telling. He simply goes out into a landscape, familiarizes himself with a place, and then starts to work to create something beautiful. He takes something and makes it beautiful in a landscape and complements the landscape. The other beautiful thing I love about his work is that all of his pieces are designed to disappear as nature takes its course. And so it's here a moment and then gone. Ice melts, wind blows, rain falls. It makes his work transitory. It's just a moment of beauty on top of a chaotic terrain. And I love, this is, I think, perhaps one of my favorite, because all he simply did was walk out into this landscape and see fall leaves and go, wait, if I took all the really bright yellow ones and put them right against the trunk and then had the colors go out this way, it would create this, oh, it's gorgeous. But all he did is, what do I have to work with? Leaves? Okay. How can I bring some order and bring a temporary, brief moment of beauty? His artwork is so unique because each piece is tied to a physical location, a space, and the season of the year, time. See, his works are these temporary, fragile moments of beauty in a particular place and time. The very fabric of his art is simply take what's in front of you, make a piece for a time, for now. It doesn't worry about the future. And sometimes you see his beauty, it just falls apart in seconds. And he's left just sighing. And yet, even though his work is temporary, the art brings beauty and grace and the sense of enchantment for a moment. And it seems to me that this is a great metaphor for what it means to travel the Christian path, what it's all about. It's, to me, what it means to seek first Jesus' kingdom and his righteousness and his path. It's what it means to practice the little way. The idea isn't we need to do something great that will last into the future. The idea is take what's around you, what's in your landscape, and do something beautiful with it. Don't worry about how long it will last or if it's impactful. And his process to me is virtually a manual for living into Jesus' path. Temporary moments of beauty tied to a particular space and time. And then he walks away. Not worried about the future. Not worried if it will last or even be noticed. And I tell you, when I look at his art, I think to myself, I want to live and move throughout my days like that. What I mean by that is this. Today, each of us are going to wander out into a world, a landscape littered with different people in different places. And there's always going to be the temptation to constantly sort of take future trips into a world of fear and anxiety and worry about, oh my goodness, what am I doing next week? And I've got this issue to deal with. Or maybe what preoccupies our mind is, you know, how can I make sure that I have some sort of legacy and impact in my work and the people I'm with? How can I make sure that I have some sort of meaningfulness towards my life? But I think there's another way to live and move. And I think it's more like this, to simply be awake, aware, open, present, familiar. Here's what I have to work with around me. Could I now, in this moment, make some small gesture of beauty and love and grace, and it doesn't matter if it lasts. Because if we work like Goldworthy in our lives, how we would operate is simple. We would simply try to find in our landscapes and bring grace and beauty to that. And it could be as simple as you look around this room this morning and go, this is my landscape that I'm working with right now. What does this moment need in terms of bringing grace and beauty and love there? And it could be something as simple as you're in a conversation after and go, you know what, this could use a bit of humor right here. Or maybe as you're interacting with people, you sense, you know what, as I'm getting familiar here, this person seems a little discouraged. I wonder if just a word of encouragement, what that might do. Or you know what? I think I just need to be quiet and listen here because I think somebody's saying something interesting. Maybe there's a kind gesture I need to add to this situation. Who knows? Because the question can only be answered by being fully awake to what is around us, working with what we have in this time, in this space. And there's no formula to it because it's artistry we're talking about here. Artistry, taking time to listen and learn about the people around us, the people at Nexus, at home, at work, on our street. Who are they? What are their dreams? I wonder where they hurt. And then once we know the materials and rhythms of their experience, we'll try to, you know what, maybe I can create a moment of beauty and grace in the lives of this person or community or this street. And like Goldsworthy, we won't be able to control the outcome. That's the beauty of it. There are times when you maybe try something and your efforts will collapse and come to nothing. Or maybe you make a kind gesture and somebody doesn't even notice. It doesn't work. And all you can do is with Goldsworthy is just, okay, all right. There'll be times when our work is forgotten by tomorrow. That's just how it goes. But we still move ahead with just trying to bring just a slice of beauty or peace or truth or grace to the world, and then we relinquish control. And to be honest, I think that alone can ease our worry and stress in life, because when we stop obsessing over whether or not our work in life is somehow meaningful, or whether the Nexus community is doing enough meaningful things, then we're simply free to create, knowing, I get it, my work will rarely last beyond this moment, but so what? I think we need to be freed from the tyranny of thinking we have to do things that will have a lasting impact, freed from the tyranny of thinking our job is to fix the world or fix other people, freed from the Messiah complex that comes with all of that. Fixing is not our job. And there's an eschatological hope to the Christian path for a reason. God will fix all things. Jesus says, I will make all things new. That's not my job. That's not my job. My job is to live as an artist. Artists who can point to and provide signs of grace and forgiveness and love and resurrection for the world. And we can experience that now, in this moment, in this place. After all, Jesus did say, my kingdom is in your midst. And if that's true, then maybe our small, temporary acts of beauty and grace and love might allow somebody to catch a glimpse of it. And so as we begin a brand new season here, full of promise and potential, I wanted to take us back first to where we left off last year, a commission to not allow ourselves to be fleeced by living too far in imagined futures of worries and troubles, but to be awake today in this moment, your own personal landscape, what is right in front of you, what is right in front of us. And as we do, may we pick up this call to be artists of beauty. And it might not last, it might even go unnoticed, but it points to the one who is beautiful, the beauty behind all things. And so, therefore, I tell you, do not worry about your life, but seek first his kingdom and his righteousness, and all these things will be given to you as well. I want to close with a prayer right now. And this Kit passed this prayer on to me a couple of months ago, and it's I think it's just a wonderful prayer, and I want to close this morning with this prayer. And I think it fits. I've adjusted it a little bit to us here as we begin a new season together, and sort of sums up what we are called to. So if you'll join me in prayer now. God of history and of our hearts, so much has happened to us during the whirlwind days of summer. We've known death and birth. We've been brave and scared. We've hurt. We've helped. We've been honest. We've lied. We've destroyed. We've created. We've been with people. We've been lonely. We've been loyal. We've betrayed. We've decided. We've waffled. We've laughed and we have cried. You know our frail hearts and our frayed history, and now another season begins. O God. Help us to believe in beginnings and our beginning again. No matter how often we failed before, help us to make beginnings, to begin going out of our weary minds into fresh dreams, daring to make our own bold tracks into the land of now, to begin forgiving that we may experience mercy, to begin questioning the unquestionable that we may know truth, to begin disciplining that we may create beauty, to begin sacrificing that we may make peace, to begin loving that we may realize joy. Help us to be a beginning to others, to be singers to the songless, storytellers to the aimless, befrienders of the friendless, to become a beginning of hope for the despairing, of assurance for the doubting, of reconciliation for the divided, to become a beginning of freedom for the oppressed, of comfort for the sorrowing, of friendship for the forgotten, to become a beginning of beauty for the forlorn, of sweetness for the soured, of gentleness for the angry, of wholeness for the broken, of peace for the frightened and violent of the earth. Help us to believe in beginnings, to make a beginning, to be a beginning, so that we may not just grow old, but grow new each day of this wild, amazing life you call us to live with the passion of Jesus Christ. Amen. Go in peace.